I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, where we welcome Alice Walker, one of the most prolific writers of our time. She has a new book. It's a collection of essays. Alice, as you know, for the past several years, has been living on a farm north of San Francisco, and she has diligently cared for a flock of chickens. And this book is a series of letters, really, that she has written to them with profound thoughts, letters when she was in other parts of the world, like India, visiting the Dalai Lama, also in Bali and in other places. It is synthesizing the life experiences of humans and animals. It weaves in her early memories of her family. She is well known for so much of her writing. Her first short story, To Hell With Dying, which was discovered by the poet Langston Hughes in 1967 to the Pulitzer Prize winning The Color Purple. And she has done so many volumes of poetry. There is poetry in this book as well. She has a lot to talk about. It is a pleasure to speak with. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Alice Walker, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Her latest book is The Chicken Chronicles, Sitting with the Angels Who Have Returned with My Memories. Glorious, Rufus, Gertrude Stein, Splendor, Hortensia, Agnes of God, The Gladysses, and Babe. 1-800-486-8655 is our number, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Alice.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm happy to be there with you.
Tell me about your mom ordering chickens from Sears and Roebuck. I thought that was a really interesting memory.
Well, it is amazing. She did, and they arrived, and they were in a big cardboard box, and they were cute as little buttons.
And did she in any way have the same kind of relationship with those chickens that you have had with yours?
She did. They all had names, and she treated them with great tenderness. And this is what I remembered, that you know, we had to eat them because we were poor and we, you know, had to have food. But the tenderness came before that, you know, and that is why partly why I wrote this, to remind us that we don't have to endure factory farming, which is only about 50 years old in this country, and we can figure out other ways to relate to the beings who sustain us, who actually give their lives to our lives.
It's so interesting, the relationship that you had with your chickens and have with your chickens, and the relationships they have with each other.
Oh, I know. I know, especially the two, Rufus and Agnes of God, we thought were roosters because they were so aggressive and they were always jumping up and actually, you know, sometimes pecking me. But it turned out that they were, you know, like all of them, hens, and this was just their nature.
And at one point you were a little bit worried. I think it was Rufus, wasn't it? You had to farm Rufus out for a while because she had gone over the edge.
Well, she had, and she had become something of a little batterer, and I had to send her. But, you know, it was so interesting because she reminded me so much of a couple that I had known in which the husband was a batterer, and the wife, you know, changed completely whenever the husband was around. And so Gertrude Stein actually changed a lot when Rufus was around, and that's why I decided to send Rufus away for a few days to see, you know, if Gertrude Stein would, you know, feel more comfortable.
And did she?
She did. Although, you know, it was very funny. I thought that it was all about Rufus being a bully. But actually, after 5 days, Rufus came back, mainly looking for her nest because she was, you know, needing to lay her eggs. And for some reason, there was a wonderful calm. Everybody just ignored her, and she pretty much ignored them, too. So I don't know, you know, chicken psychology, they definitely have their own ways.
Talk about the eggs that you got. I mean, we're talking not just brown eggs, which I think are your favorites, but we're talking blue eggs and different color eggs. How does that come about?
From the Americanas. The Americanas, much to my delight, lay green and blue eggs. They're very pale, but, you know, definitely green and blue. And interestingly, there are some people who won't eat the green eggs. I met a woman down in Georgia whose husband saw the green eggs and just would not eat the eggs. And, you know, we had a nice little discussion about, you know, what do you do with someone who just balks at eating an egg just because it's green? But anyway, yes, they have, you know, differently colored eggs, and their plumage is also extraordinary. It's so beautiful.
I must say that I've never I will now, but I haven't seen a chicken since I wrote your book, or since I read your book. I never thought about the elaborateness of a chicken. You really have studied what they look like.
Oh, some of them are so exquisite. And this is the other thing. I want children, especially, who eat, you know, people in this country eat, I think it is a million chickens an hour or a day or something.
Woo!
And they never think what they look like, you know, how they are, who they are, you know, what their character was like, nothing. And this is an impoverishment of our own spirit, among other, you know, things. But I wanted children to know that actually I'm not condemning what they eat. I'm just wanting them to realize that what they're eating is glorious, is beautiful, is amazing in its own being.
And yet you have changed your eating patterns. You're mostly a vegetarian.
Yes. I like to say I'm as vegetarian as my chickens, because like them, I eat mostly grains and plants and fruit. But occasionally, you know, they will see a bug and they will go off and eat the bug or the worm. And I'm kind of like that too, you know, no bugs and worms. But from time to time, actually following my doctor's advice, I do have, you know, chicken or fish.
When you were a child, did you have to kill chickens?
I did. And I think that's partly why it was so amazing to me to see this chicken I saw in Bali, who started this whole thing, you know, maybe 25 years ago. I knew that I needed to go back to understanding what had happened to my relationship to chickens. And I realized it was disrupted because at some point as a 8 or 9 year old, it devolved to me as the, you know, the last child left in the family to be the one to wring the neck of the chicken we ate for dinner. And knowing me and my tenderheartedness, that must have just sent me over the edge.
I can imagine. You did it, being that young and having to do that.
Well, that's the reality for millions of children on the planet.
Exactly.
Today.
Exactly. And we don't think about that, do we? We just go buy it in the grocery store and there's our chicken.
Yes, and that's to our detriment. That is my point, that you have to start to know what it is you're eating. You really have to start to know that. Otherwise, there's a shallowness that develops in people, and we're just kind of gliding along on the surface of things. I mean, the reality is that, you know, the real meaning of sin, probably, is that you have to do a lot of things that you really wish you didn't have to, but in some extremity of need, you do them. And so there you are. It's the human condition.
And not only are you concerned about what you are eating, there are some delightful passages about your concern over what the chickens are eating.
Well, yes. Well, I built the chicken condo, beautiful. Oh, it's so, so lovely, right next to my garden so that they get the best of everything, because I want them to have, you know, really good greens, which are just the best thing for humans and anybody. And so that's what we do. I mean, I shake down apples for them, and I give them plums. And when persimmons are ripe or not quite so ripe, I give them those. I give them corn on the cob. Ah, they are very.
They've got a life.
They have it good. I mean, you know, they don't even know about factory farming, and I, you know, I will never tell them.
You're not going to write a letter to them in every card.
I will never let them know that such a thing could happen to them. They are too beautiful.
You pull it off, but where did you ever think about this format of the book, that it's really, it's essays, but it's a series of letters that you've written when you're in Bali and India and all of these places having these remarkable experiences, but you're obviously thinking about these chickens, and so you write to them.
Well, you know, it's not really essays, it's a chronicle. You know, it should be daily, but it's not quite daily, but it's a chronicle, and I'm keeping up with their day-to-day activities, and I am thinking of them. I mean, I'm thinking about them when I'm with the Dalai Lama. I'm thinking about them when I'm with Gandhi's granddaughter, Tara. I'm thinking about them when I see the elephants, you know, in India. I'm thinking about them when I see the ducks in Kerala. You know, they're very real to me.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk a little bit about being with Gandhi's granddaughter, there are, for some reason, there are a lot of books about Gandhi coming out right now. And you have spent a lot of profound time thinking about him, I'm sure, who he was in the world, what he put into his body, what kind of statement he was making to the rest of the world. Tell me about his granddaughter, Alice.
Well, we just loved each other on sight.
Oh.
Fell into each other's arms. She took me by the hand and never let go. She took me to the spot where he was assassinated. We just, you know, we still feel that bond across time and, you know, space with this person who was such a fine teacher for us. He was a really good teacher, and part of it was his honesty. You know, he talked about in his one of his autobiographies, My Experiments with Truth, about the reality of his child marriage to Kasturba, who was 13, and he was 13. And because, you know, at that age, your sexual nature is sometimes quite overpowering, it meant that he was very dominating and very domineering and actually cruel to her. And this turned out to be one of the great regrets of his life. And in a way, it wasn't his fault, because the tradition was, I mean, some of it was his fault, but the tradition of having people marry when they're 13, I mean, you know, really, I mean, what do you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. What do you know when you're 13? And what about your meeting with the Dalai Lama?
Well, there I was making a pilgrimage to all the wise people I could think of to try to help us with many of the thorniest problems on the planet, like, you know, what to do about Burma, you know, Myanmar, and also about Israel and Palestine. And, you know, it seems to me that part of what has to happen is that we do go and, you know, sit at the feet of people who have some wisdom and who have really in their own lives, you know, done incredible work to stay upright. And so I went with a friend who actually almost didn't let me get a word in edgewise, but when I could, I said, you know, what about these two things? And he had some really good thoughts. One was that in Myanmar, Burma, the real people pulling the strings are the Chinese, and I think that's very true, because they are, you know, taking so much of the resources of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Palestine and Israel, the council was to really support and befriend the peacemakers in both groups, and always remember that you know, that's who you're supporting, not one people over the other, but the peacemakers in each group. And this was just, you know, it was actually what Code Pink, the women's organization that I work with, also, you know, has the discipline to do. But it was wonderful to sit there and hear him say it so succinctly.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it interesting, and you write about this in one of your letters, that you've got this incredible rootedness in the relationship with the chickens and the farm and knowing about the foxes and the land, and then there you are in India looking at elephants, and you're in Bali and you're with the Dalai Lama. There's this huge international witness part to your life as well, and an activist.
Mm-hmm. Well, that keeps me going, actually. I'm inspired by my own activism, and whatever I'm drawn to, I have a feeling it will work. It will, you know, it may take 100 years, but I have such a deep faith that if I'm drawn to it, there's something about it that means that the wheel is turning, and I love having that feeling. I went to Mississippi in 66, I think it was 66, by myself, because I felt again that, you know, if I could just put myself there and give it everything I had, the wheel would start to turn. You know, it was already turning. But, you know, I mean, you just have the sense that if we show up, you know, if we just show up, that something has to change. And I think that's why I love so much the Egyptian uprising, because when I saw all those people surrounding all those tanks, they had all shown up, and that is, you know, half the battle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is something to watch a lot of people show up for something
and in
important.
Wisconsin, too. Yay.
People have been showing up. They care pretty deeply about what's going on in this state.
Yep.
What do you think is going to happen?
Who knows? But the people will win. And that's you know, my faith. And I believe it with every fiber of my being. And that the people themselves must believe this. Hmm. That they, in their numbers, will win.
I have asked you to tell me this before, but I don't know very many people who met Martin Luther King, and he had a profound effect on your life. And I want you to tell me this story again, and our listeners, of when you met him as a student at Spelman College.
Oh, I know. Oh, it was so strange. Anyway, I had this incredible speech teacher who I now realize was gay, which is very interesting. But anyway, so Mr. Cochran said, because of the politics of the school, you know, they were very conservative and they wanted us to be ladies. But anyway, he said, now you can go and hear Martin Luther King speak, but this is a speech class, so we don't want to hear anything about his politics. Just, you know.
Right.
So I ended up writing about what he was wearing.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was wearing this incredibly beautiful gray shark skin, you know, it wasn't really shark skin, it's whatever that fabric is. Very kind of shiny. And he made this incredible speech. He was gorgeous. He was articulate. He was just, you know, fabulous. But I couldn't say a word about anything he really was about. So I just talked about, you know, how great he looked and, you know, all of that. But the speech was profoundly challenging for all of us because we were kind of trying to desegregate Atlanta. And we really needed the support of someone older, you know, than we were as students to help us with that. And he certainly did. And then when I, later, the March on Washington, I was there listening. I was sitting in a tree, actually. And that's where he told us all to go back to the South. You know, the tradition had been to flee from the South. And he said, go back. And that's why I went back to Mississippi. I mean, I went to Mississippi. I'm actually from Georgia, but I went to Mississippi because if I had gone to Georgia, my parents would have freaked out.
We welcome phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. Alice Walker is our guest this hour. Alice has a new book just released, The Chicken Chronicles, Sitting with the Angels Who Have Returned with My Memories, Glorious Rufus, Gertrude Stein, Splendor, Hortensia, Agnes of God, The Gladyses, and Babe. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Alice Walker. Mary in Woodruff, our first caller. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Well, you know, I've named all my chickens, too. Gertrude Stein was the name of one of my chickens until it was killed by a dog.
Oh.
But, yeah, I mean, chickens are so fascinating. And I've often thought that someone who could tape the activities of a chicken in a chicken yard and all their intricacies and their curious behaviors and the way they interact with people and with each other would be fascinating for senior citizens. I think that should be played on big screen TVs at senior homes. And I think it would take some of these people back to memories of incredible relaxation and thoughts of youth and comforts of home. And it would be really beneficial to them. And I don't know what you think about that, but...
Alice.
Oh, I think it's great. I think we should do it. Well, I also just have to mention how much I love midwives, though. I just heard the announcement about them. I just send out a big hug to all midwives. This is the right track to get people back to being born properly.
Absolutely. So I have to run out and buy your book. I can't wait to read it. Thank you for writing it.
Bye.
Thanks, Mary, very much for the call. I was amazed that I can't remember who it was, but... You have some of the chickens who actually sit on your lap.
Oh, they do. I mean, that's the thing that people don't generally understand or know. I didn't. But I was, you know, I'm bringing these chickens up and living with them with two little boys who are my neighbors. And they had basically just felt, you know, treated them with such sweetness that the first day that came, we put them in the chicken condo. I sat on my little green stool. And before I knew anything, they just sat in my lap. And it was all over after that, you know. I mean, they were just like cats, you know, just amazing. And that's one of my favorite things, to just, you know, sit down and see who's going to jump up on my one knee and then on the other knee and cuddle with them.
What about the deaths of the chickens?
Oh, God, horrible. Horrible. Mm. I mean, the first one, I just didn't think I could stand it. Oh, And, you know, and then I realized after I lost, you know, I don't know, maybe six chickens to various predators, only one to a human error. The others to, you know, bobcat, a hawk, a fox, and I don't know what else. But it each time it was just really awful because they're so, you know, they're so wise and yet they're so vulnerable because they can't really fly very fast or very high. And the most, you know, disturbing one I think was maybe Glorious. I was just sitting with her and we were having just a wonderful time sitting under the windmill, you know, just in the summer. It was the same week that Michael Jackson died, and I was really in mourning, and I went up the hill to turn off something I'd left on the stove, and 15 minutes later I came back and she had been snatched away by a hawk.
Oh my.
And it was really very, very difficult. But the thing that I really think is good for us in all of this is just to understand that this is what happens. You know, you cannot control everything. Mommies can't be everywhere. Only nature can be everywhere, and nature has its ways.
Hmm. Let's talk a little more about Michael Jackson. St. Michael is one of the chapters. Dear girls, the week that Michael Jackson died, Mommy was in a state of shock. She could do nothing, really, but come and sit with you. Why? Why were you in a state of shock?
Oh, my goodness. I never expected Michael to die that day, and he didn't either, I'm sure. And because there is in my heart and in the hearts of people around the world a great affection and love for him, and an understanding that in some ways he was a sacrifice, that he was consumed by his admirers, almost as if he had been a chicken, you know. I mean, the thoughtlessness of some of the overconsumption of Michael Jackson is kind of like the thoughtless consumption of, you know, of chickens. I mean, nobody really, really appreciated what he really, really looked like, for instance, which was beautiful. I mean, there was no reason on earth for him to ever do anything to himself, I mean, except just exist. So it's that kind of thing, you know. He's a real symbol for us in this culture of the harm that we can do to ourselves physically and psychically by not believing in our own beauty.
And you wrote him a very long poem to St. Michael, lover of animals and children.
Yes, I did. And actually, that piece, it was much longer. We trimmed it because, you know, how you trim things. But I think I may have mentioned that at some point I wrote him a letter when he was being accused of all those awful things that I didn't believe he did. And I offered him a master class in which I would talk to him about not being so trusting, because I think that one of the harms done to celebrities when they're really young is that they're too young to develop for themselves a sense of who to trust. And, of course, as we all know, he had, you know, parents and advisors who were mostly interested in making money. And
sure.
So he was harmed in that way. So I wrote him this letter, and I sent it by Quincy Jones, who, you know, is a good friend of Michael's, or was, and Michael never responded. And later on, I reread my letter, and I think, I don't know if this is what happened, but at some point I said in the letter, you know, come as yourself and leave all long cars at home, because the whole star thing is such a, you know, it can really devour you, trip you up, fool you, make you crazy. Whereas if you just show up with your backpack, you know, I think you probably have a chance.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Did he visit you at your farm ever?
Never. And I'm so sorry, because I tell you, I think I would have been good for him.
I think you're right. I think being there definitely would have been good for him. Carolyn is calling next from Madison. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello. Oh, how wonderful that Alice has a new book. Just yesterday, I ate a mallard duck egg that I had hard-boiled last weekend, and that had been sitting in the fridge for a couple weeks, and it was found by a gardener who does rooftop gardens, and one day she went up on the roof and there was a duck sitting on eggs.
Right.
It flew away. And the next day, the eggs were still there, but she wasn't. And so Anne brought me the eggs, three of them. And they were weird. It was so weird. So they sat in my fridge, and the eggs were cold. It was, you know, we've had a cold spring. All right, well, so yesterday I finally opened one of them. I didn't know what I was going to find. Was I going to find a baby, you know, something recognizable? Anyway, it ended up being a wonderful egg to eat. It was so good. The yolk was so golden and so interesting to look at, to imagine it was going to be a baby duck. You know, how is this going to be a baby duck? I never thought about that when I looked at an egg before. Well, anyway, it was, I have the other two left. I haven't eaten them. And the shells are kind of pretty. It was just so weird. It just took me a long time. I'm not recommending that people go out and gather eggs off a nest or anything, but, well, anyway, it was a wonderful connection, too. It was just cool all around.
Alice.
Yes?
Oh, I just thought you wanted to respond.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, your comment makes me think about my other interest at this point, which is to encourage humans to stop overpopulating. Because what is happening and has already happened is that we steal space from the other creatures, and they have nowhere to have to lay their eggs or to, you know, forage or to do all the things that they need to do. So she was actually up on the roof because she had lost a place for, you know, that was more safe and protected for her. And, you know, this is something that collectively we have to really think about seriously. The patriarchal way of just projecting, you know, like in 20 years we're going to be, you know, 10 billion thousand, you know, more, and is just outdated. We cannot have it. And women have to have a stronger voice in saying that we will not continue to make the earth try to support more than she can. I mean, have some pity. So that's what your comments, you know, where I was taken, that we have to stop this overpopulation that people think of as some kind of natural thing, but it isn't. It's very out of balance.
Thank you, Carolyn, for your call. I want to talk about elephants for a moment. I know you went to India and you kept looking for the chickens, and you saw elephants, and elephants fascinate me. I think they're really smart, but you saw them in chains, and you were perturbed by that. But of course, one thought leads to a lot of deeper thoughts with you, Alice. So, can you relate that experience for us?
Well, while I was in southern India looking for chickens, which I, you know, couldn't see anywhere, I did run into all of these elephants, and they are all chained and working elephants. You know, I mean, they do this when they're little. They put them, you know, chain them to a tree, and then they get away. And then they, even though later on the tree is not there, they can still be controlled. It's really psychologically pretty intense. And it was disturbing because they're such noble creatures. And when I went up to touch one, I could just feel the being there. So it's just like, you know, it chaining someone that is totally conscious of being chained and quite conscious of being away from his or her family. And this is a consciousness that I want for humans. I want humans to understand that just because somehow we manage to be at the, quote, top of the heap, you know, not knowing what we're doing most of the time, it doesn't mean that, you know, everybody else, all the other creatures, are somehow less than we are. I mean, they're here. And they deserve to have a space on this planet. This is their planet, you know, just as much as it is our planet. And actually, it seems to be more so to me because they know how to live here. We don't.
And there are so many of them. Doesn't it just knock you out sometimes when you think about all the animals there are? It's astounding.
Well, but we're getting rid of them at a clip.
Right.
So really is so important for us to just think about them as something other than, you know, something that's there for us. They're here for themselves. And I really, you know, the elephants are so, they're so noble. I mean, they and they're so, they have, you know, if they lose a partner, if they lose a child, you know, their grief is very deep, and they keep going back if they can, you know, to where they bury their families. And they're smart, you know, and they're beautiful. I mean, they're just, you know, all these creatures that we so blithely push over the edge, you know, just take all their space and then they die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are gorgeous, and it would be so good for us to have that beauty, to start to live in the glow of that kind of exquisiteness that nature gives to this planet.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, just because I was wondering what your response to this would be, but we've lived through this major event this week, of course, with the killing of Osama bin Laden, and some controversy on the web now about whether or not we should have tried to take this person as a prisoner and have a court before the world to talk about evil and to condemn the actions in a very public way. What were you thinking when all this news happened this week, Alice, and what do you think about it now and the changing story?
Well, I haven't been keeping up with the changing story, but I was in D.C. when this happened.
Oh, were you?
And so my friends went over to the White House to see what was happening there, and they encounter all these drunken young people wrapped in the flag, just hilariously and euphorically exulting in the murder of this person. And I just don't have that gene. I don't have a single place in my body that is happy for anybody's murder.
Hmm.
Or, as they say, killing, which actually is a way of putting him in the realm of animals. And I really think that we have to remember, as John Donne, I think, said, any person's death diminishes me, you know, and it can be someone you think of as your enemy. But the other truth is that he is not, bin Laden is not the only person who is harming people. I mean, who is a terrorist. I mean, if a terrorist is someone who is bombing apartment buildings, you know, whatever, towers, places in the world, then look at who's doing that everywhere. I mean, it is so not honest to claim that this person is the personification of evil, and if you get rid of him, you know, things are going to be fine. Well, no, good luck. They're not.
And what about the president? I'm struck by all that was going on. I'm anxious to read the book about his mother, actually, which we're going to do on May 19th. But I was so struck.
Who wrote the book about his mother?
Oh, what's her name? I just got the book yesterday. I haven't started writing it. Scott, I think her last name is. Chrissy's looking it up. So she's a very young. I just saw her on television the other day, and she just seems so friendly. And she spent quite a bit of time in Indonesia, and she was real straightforward. And I'm real excited. Janie Scott, her name is. Mm-hmm. I don't know very much about her, but that is her name.
Yeah, but I was just thinking, well, hoping in a way that he was writing it. But you know, how can you write a book if you're trying to
do all the things he is.
Right. Cover the universe.
Right. And I'm interested, take it in terms of the weekend with him, but or wherever you'd like, but this, you know, he's telling this funny story about Donald Trump, and he's also thinking about this action that's about to take place in Pakistan, and he's looking at the victims of tornadoes in the south, and then stopping in to look at the space launch. I'm thinking about all that goes on in this man's life and
well,
how he's dealing with all
actually
of this.
The truth is that should not be the work of one person, and it should not be.
Oh.
Our system needs to be redone. We need to do something very different. The times have changed. This is not, you know, our revolutionary fathers, you know, actually Jefferson, whom I actually like a lot, reminded us that, you know, when things are not working that well, you have, as citizens, you can change them. And this is a place where we need to look at whether this kind of leadership actually works.
Hmm.
Or whether we elect these people and then drive them into the ground when they try to cover all the battles and everything that's happening and do it well. And it's impossible. You can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so in his case, I think he's often surrounded by people that personally I wouldn't trust. And so it makes me feel that he's in a very dangerous position.
Let's go to Sean next. Hi, Sean.
Well, hello, Kathleen. Hi. Terrific show as always. I'm actually calling in for two quick reasons, and one is to say, Ms. Walker, I, as a man, and 42 years struggling to be a feminist man, that I have been greatly moved and guided by your work and your writings, and I'm listening to you now, and it's reminding me that in all the years I've heard you speak and read your words, I don't think I have heard a single idea with which I do not agree, and that is so rare. I just want to thank you for your work, and I look forward to the next 50 or 60 years of your writing.
Oh, good. My great-great-great-great-grandmother lived to be 125.
Are you serious?
I'm serious, of a heart attack, and, you know, and she was just... Her theory was that you'll live a long time if you don't cover up the pulse at your throat. So all everybody out there. But she actually, you know, she outlived everybody who'd ever owned her. And I love that. And that should be the medicine that we take into our battles, you know. That, you know, I'm just going to outlive you.
125.
I know. And Uncle Henry lived to be 100. Well, he lived longer than 108. I saw him at 108, and, well, he'd become kind of like a little baby. So that wasn't so cheerful. But, you know, people can live a long time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sean, unless you had something else.
Well, just thanks for having great guests.
You're entirely welcome. Our great pleasure. Alice Walker is our guest this hour, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to send one of those, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Her latest book is The Chicken Chronicles, Sitting with the Angels Who Have Returned with My Memories, Glorious Rufus, Gertrude Stein, Splendor, Hortensia, Agnes of God, the Gladysses, and Babe. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I meant to thank you once again for contributing to Wisconsin Public Radio. We had that one-day Wednesday pledge drive yesterday. It was a whole other reality for us, but it was really successful. 3,700 members pledged, and we're pleased to welcome over 800 new members to Wisconsin Public Radio Association. We do need money to keep what we're doing, and you are very generous. You donated over $359,000 to help the networks of Wisconsin Public Radio, your WPR station, and the programming that you depend on. So, muchas gracias. Let's go to more phone calls for Alice Walker, Joy in West Bend. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to Alice Walker directly. I raise chickens and have had some wonderful relationships with chickens, but that's not what I called about. What inspired me today was you saying when you want to help get peace between nations, you need to support the peacemakers, and I've thought about this a lot lately. I teach a class about ancient women's spirituality and power, about how throughout human history, most of the time, you know, the women have been the ones who were revered goddesses, and women were probably at least half of the leadership, if not more than half of the leadership of cultures in the way past. Anyway, I thought that, you know, if we had enough women in leadership now, then women would feel safe to say the kind of wisdom that we have about how to get to peace, or how to take care of the earth, or, you know, how to live a good life. Mm-hmm. And I just want to know what you think about that.
Well, the weapons manufacturers really don't want that to happen, and they have a lot of power. But I totally agree with you. I think that if we had enough women, we could change a lot. I was in Rwanda a couple of years ago, and because of the genocide there, one of the, you know, positive things is that they have more women leaders in parliament and elsewhere than any other country. And I can say to you that there is a palpable feeling of you know, what the difference that makes, a feeling of much more safety and a feeling of much more comfort, and a feeling that the children are or a priority in a way that in some countries one doesn't feel that. So I think that we see what happens when we have like one or two women. They don't feel that they have a lot of power, and they don't. I mean, they need to have a circle. They need to have more women. They need to have women to you know, bend the ideas around and do some deep thinking, and they need time with other women who have a sense of direction, a different direction from the one we're going in, which is really scary. I you know, there's the Nostradamus prediction and prophecy about this period, which is all about war, and of course that's the truth. We're having that, and he talks about, you know, a big nuclear conflagration, which I pray is not on the agenda, you know, Japan notwithstanding. But, you know, if women had not made themselves forget what they were like before the burning times when they were burned as witches, you know, I think a lot of women have just, you know, hidden that so far down in the psyche, you know, like who they were before they were forced to be meek and mild and walk behind and not, you know, own up to being midwives and healers. You know, I think that connection has been so broken in women. And women are afraid. I mean, there's a way in which women generally, even though they may think of themselves as not being afraid, collectively share this hidden awareness that still has an impact, you know, psychically. And they're just not standing in their full glory and in their full power in the way that they were in the times that you study and teach in matriarchal times.
Thank you, Joy, very much for the call. You don't need this information, but others might, Alice, because you have this right outside your door. But a listener called in to recommend a website, which is flyingskunk.com. It's the live cam of a chicken farm on Martha's Vineyard. Hey, maybe you should do that. Have you thought about that, doing a webcam?
About my chickens?
Yeah.
No, because I don't want to exploit them. I mean, I think it's okay to write about them and to have, you know, a book about them, but I don't have people going up and taking photographs and or you know, looking in on them. They're having a very peaceful life, and I have a few photographs that I send out when people want to see, you know, see what they look like, you know, taken, I don't know, maybe a year ago. But I don't have an interest in you know, making much of a to-do. I just would like to have people, and especially younger people, understand that they can start now repairing their relationship to the animals of the earth.
You have other animals as well. Do you have a particular... I'm kind of a dog person, maybe because I, you know, live in the city, and I don't live on a farm, although I may at some point, and I really love dogs.
I love dogs too. I had a
I know
lab.
You.
Yeah, my lab Marley died years ago. She was 13, and a more beautiful, soulful being never existed. In fact, I used to tell her all the time, you know, you remind me of my mother.
Oh. And did you get another one, Alice?
Well, my partner has one. His dog is Miles, named for Miles Davis.
Great.
And beautiful, part coyote. And actually just showed up one day. You know, just actually, there's some, you know, people think we humans go and pick out, you know, dogs. And we do. But in a looser sort of universe, you know, that you're living internally and in your beliefs, the dog or the cat can also come and choose you. And that happened to him with his dog, and it happened to me with the cat that I have now. They just, you know, they just showed up for us. And it's a perfect match.
It's great.
Isn't it?
It is great. It is, yeah, it's great. It's great to share the world.
Lies. I mean, the whole thing is just ongoing.
Yes, it is. Every darn day, it's wonderful. And I want to hear more about this whole order. From observing your chickens, are they peaceful creatures? How do they deal with bad behavior among them? I just want to know more about their pecking order.
Oh, well, they have that. And, you know, in fact, when the Gang of Six arrived, they were vicious, all the ones that you know, had the full run of everything and both my knees to roost on and all the good food, and they did not want to share, and this was so upsetting to me. I just couldn't believe it. I was over them for about 2 days. And then, you know, my friend said, well, you know, be realistic. They're chickens, and they have a pecking order, and, you know, get over it. And you know, over time, but it took several months for them to mellow out and to relate in an equitable way with each other, with the newcomers.
Mm-hmm. How long do they live?
Oh, God, I don't know, and I don't think about it. Long enough. I mean, I would be happy if they outlived me. I feel that way about my cat, too.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I look at her, I think, oh, may you outlive me.
And what about your own mortality? Is that something that you don't think about in your own life either, or as you get older?
No, I think about it all the time.
Do you?
In fact, I think that it, you know, oh, the ways that we have been misguided. You know, the avoidance of mortality, the thinking about mortality, the avoidance of thinking about your own death, you know, really shallows us. I mean, it makes us so, like, you know, where's your depth if you don't, you know that death is always on your shoulder, and that you have to live in that shadow, in that reality, and therefore do your best, because, it, you know, the day is coming and you never know when. So, no, I think I learned in Mississippi, because they were assassinating people and they were firebombing houses and they were, you know, doing all the traditional, you know, racist things. I learned that it really was a good idea to take nothing for granted, not even the next breath, and to live there, you know, to live there in that moment, and that, you know, lo and behold, is actually where the joy is.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is no, you know, next moment or the back moment. I mean, they're either not here or they've passed. And so you live right in the one that you inhabit. And it's a great place.
It is a great place.
Mm-hmm.
And what prompts you, what happens in your head or in your heart that prompts you to say, well, I need to go now to see the Dalai Lama. I need to go be with Gandhi's granddaughter. I need to go to work with the Code Pink group. How do you decide where you're going to go next?
I meditate a lot.
Really?
I do. And I had planned not to go anywhere. But I lived part of the year in Mexico, actually. And so I was down there on my little cushion thinking that, oh, joy, I'm not, you know, in the United States where, you know, things can make you just go crazy. And I thought I would just, you know, take the year if I could. And I couldn't do that, and that's how my chicken started too. Because what came up was this yearning to reconnect with the chicken nation, and also to go to Gaza. And that happened because my sister, with whom I had been very close for a long time, died. She's older than me, and she's been very sick. And we had not had a good time in the last few years of her life, and so I thought, oh, you know, I won't be devastated by this death. And it just completely devastated me.
Mm.
And then I heard on the radio that five children of a woman in Gaza had died from, you know, the Israeli bombing, and that the woman herself was unconscious. And I just thought, my God, if I'm devastated by the death of one, you know, basically old woman here, my sister, who was sick and who was in pain and who really, you know, death was in some ways a relief. If I'm devastated by this, how is this woman going to feel if she wakes up and they tell her, five of your daughters are dead?
How
is she going to feel? Who's going to tell her that?
Mm-hmm.
So since we buy the bombs and, you know, all the apparatus of the occupation and the repression of the Palestinian people, and, you know, and I really don't agree with using my money for that, it just felt like, well, you know, here's your duty. You go there, and you sit with those women who've lost their children, and you tell them to their face that you don't agree. And that's what I did.
You showed up.
I did.
Showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Alice Walker, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to speak with you, too.
Alice Walker, our guest. Her latest book is The Chicken Chronicles, Sitting with the Angels Who Have Returned with My Memories, Glorious, Rufus, Gertrude Stein, Splendor, Hortensia, you got to love these names, Agnes of God, The Gladysses, and Babe, a memoir. Alice Walker, a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and activist and spiritual guide, and this is an account of a chronicling of a year in the life of her flock of backyard chickens, but it also includes her time with elephants in India and the granddaughter of Gandhi and meeting with the Dalai Lama and being a witness to peace, for peace, in various parts of the world. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thank you for your calls. Thank you for listening. That's about it. We'll be with you again on Monday at 9 o'clock for All Things Political. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.